Welcome to Flavors Under the Big Sky, celebrating the bounty of the region. I'm Stella Fong. In May, the Montana State University Billings Foundation once again hosted the Wine and Food Festival, a six-day event that raised scholarships with cooking schools in beautiful homes, palate-inspiring dinners, beer and food pairings, finished with a lively feast and auction. For Flavors, it's a chance to talk to the wine masters in the Yellowstone Public Radio studio. This year, Chad Johnson of Dusted Valley and Jeremy Leffert of Rabble Wine Company join us. We talk about modern wine, creative labeling, and ratings. Then in the second part of the show, Doug Reed of Rita Wine Company help us answer the question of, does the shape of a wine glass change our sipping experience? First, let's meet the wine masters who make the wine that goes into the glasses. In the studio, I have the 2018 Wine Masters for the MSUB Foundation Wine and Food Festival. Chad Johnson of Dusted Valley in Walla Walla, Washington.
Glad to be here.
And Jeremy Leffert of Rabble Wine Company in Paso Robles, California. Welcome.
Thanks for having us.
In the house.
Let's begin with your sharing with the listeners a sense of place. Take them to your winery. Let's start with Chad.
Eastern Washington, where we grow all the fruit, is a high desert, if you will. So we get an average of about 8 inches of rain. And so everything needs to be irrigated. It's 300 days of sunshine. And we do get over 100 degrees for 7 days to a week. And it's a temperate climate. So it actually gets cold. We get some snow in the winter. So it puts the vines to bed, if you will. Like most deserts, we get what's called a diurnal shift. It gets really cool in the evening compared to those daytime highs. We'll drop, 30 degrees, maintain some natural acidity and some freshness in the wines. You definitely have that New World fruit characteristic.
Jeremy, what about you?
I'm from Paso Robles. That's where Rabble Wine Company is based.
And that is in Central California-ish?
Yes, it's about halfway between Los Angeles and San Francisco, about 20 miles inland. Paso Robles is a phenomenal place to grow grapes. Background hails from the ocean, so it's marine.
You have the fog that comes in.
Right, and the soils, though, have a kind of marine parentage. It's all limestone. Mm-hmm. Ancient seabed material. There's actually whale bones and clams and stuff you can find in the rock. And we get extremely warm in the daytime. We're triple digits a lot more than 7 days. And we, like Walla Walla, also have this large diurnal swing where we'll swing up to 60 degrees. The difference between the daytime highs and the nighttime lows, which really helps our grapes maintain their acidity all the way into harvest. Washington. Like Walla Walla, these are definitely kind of modern fruit profile-driven wines.
I'm going to have you hold that thought on the modern word. But what I want also is for you to just get the listeners oriented. How did the winery begin? Where did it come from and when did it happen? Jeremy, you start.
Rabble Wine Company was started in 2007. We're growers first. We always have been. Our founder, Rob Murray, is a farmer and he got groups of people together to buy up land and start planting vineyards with the goal of selling the grapes to other wineries. And around 2007, Rob hired a winemaker to commercially make some wines to help market the grapes to other wineries. I partnered up with a brilliant graphic designer and had some vision on branding, and the brand Tooth and Nail was born with The Possessor. Was the first wine, actually. Started out with about 300 cases. Rob was selling the wines individually, and initially in 2012, we started to grow the brands by market acquisition, so without a tasting room. So we reverse engineered it, and now we're up to the four brands that we have, and we have about 1,000 acres total planted of vineyards. And still to this day, we only keep about the best 12 to 15% of the grapes. The bulk of it still is sold.
So what about you, Chad? Tell me about the beginnings
Valley. A family adventure, I guess. In 2003, my wife, her sister, and our brother-in-law, Corey, all moved out to Walla Walla. So this was kind of our exodus from corporate America, if you will. Something we had a huge interest in, a passion. It was a lot of blind ambition and good Wisconsin Midwest work ethic made it happen. So we started off with, I think, 7 tons in 2003 and have grown every year. Started with Dusted Valley. That's our more estate-driven ultra-premium brand. And after a few years, realized the opportunity for a little more accessible price point brand. So Boomtown was born, Dusted Valley's little brother. So we started expanding in distribution as well as direct-to-consumer and our wine club, the Stained Tooth Society, like 1,100 people now. And everybody knows if you drink a bunch of red wine, you end up with stained choppers.
Yes.
And we're okay with that. My dad's a dentist. He hooked me up with his toothbrush wrap back in the day. So when you join, you get a soft bristle multi-angle toothbrush. And a little bit of oral hygiene goes a long way for that.
It's a creative angle.
Yeah. So in 2003, I still kept my day job. job for 3 years, and I finally got out. So if this doesn't work, we're screwed.
I think it's working. Let's be optimistic about it.
Yeah, we've had some great press and accolades, and turning people on to Washington Wine and Walla Walla Wine, as well as our brand all the time. It's kind of our mission.
I think Walla Walla is coming into its own.
I hope so.
Yeah, Paso Robles is also, I believe.
Absolutely.
Yeah, they're both kind of the Wild West of winemaking.
Yeah.
You down in California, certainly.
They are, and we'll get to that a little bit. So let's move on to philosophy. So we're talking about Wild West. Start with you, Chad, and tell me about what your winery's philosophy is.
Yeah, so I got into wine through fine dining. So I came at it from a wine drinker's side, I guess, if you will, trying to make something that we would like and enjoy. But that doesn't always happen when you're buying fruit from places and not really knowing what the terroir is all about. Mm-hmm. I guess we've evolved into more of an estate winery and purchasing fruit from places that fit our winemaking style. And philosophy, I guess we grow, as you mentioned, we're growers first.
Yes.
I mean, ultimately. And then trying to be as much non-interventionalist as you can in a winery.
Mm-hmm.
And that always starts with great fruit. Farmers first, not messing around with the wine a whole lot when we get it into the cellar and not doing a lot of racking and things like that. And there's a winemaking team. It's Griffin Fry. He's been with us. Mm-hmm. This will be his fourth harvest. Great guy. A brother from another mother. So we've chased scores for a little bit or trends, making bigger, badder, more extracted wines. And we've really kind of pulled back a little bit from that and trying to find more nuance. And again, a lot of oak and letting terroir and really let the vineyards speak for themselves. And with the 17 vintage, all of our wines will be vineyard designate except for two of them. So we're really excited about that. Something we've been working towards as the grapes are getting a little older and we're coaxing a little bit more out of them.
That's fun.
It is fun to be able
to then have that distinctive personality between all the different vineyards and being able to do that.
I mean, it's a learning curve for sure. And we have not made our best wines. It will all come in time.
All right. We'll await that.
Please do.
Jeremy.
Drink it up. We'll make more. That's my motto.
Jeremy, tell me about your winemaking philosophy.
It's quite simple, actually. We're lucky enough to have the four ranches that I was talking about fuel the different brands. Part of the winemaking journey for me is finding out the voice of these individual vineyard blocks and having the luxury of four brands with four different wine styles that they own. Figuring out which vineyards blocks fit each program. And we take care of our crop and we're farmers first, like the folks up at Dusted Valley. And I try to be as transparent as possible in the cellar. I keep things really clean, squeaky. I top a lot. I don't rack. And I really think that's the key in letting the vineyard's voice be heard. Sure, there's new oak involved in several of our brands. You know, Tooth and Nail is about 30% new. That's these days quite a lot, but that's part of the terroir as well, because there is the winery and the flora and fauna in the winery, as well as the fauna is actually the winemaker. That's part of it.
Kinda.
That's part of the terroir as well, the winemaker's hand. And one of my kind of quests with Tooth and Nail is finding the right barrels to you. I want transparency and the barrel to highlight the vineyard and improve it.
And where are you finding these barrels? Are they coming from different places, or is it mostly France?
It's mostly France, but it's different cooperages and different toasts and working together, because they're a partner of mine.
Mm-hmm.
And each year we work towards improving it. And so they start to end up customizing things for us to fit our wines.
Yeah, we actually work with Sigmar Moe quite a bit. And Adam is a good friend of both of ours. And what works down in Paso on certain, like the Cabernet, doesn't always work on the stuff in Washington. Even from vineyard to vineyard, there's differences.
Imagine that is just infinite.
Your decision making as a winemaker, you have to be very careful, because there's no knee-jerk reaction that's going to work with winemaking.
Yeah, you burn the toast, you throw it out and start again with wine, and you're stuck with it.
You know, we were talking at breakfast that, like, one of the coolest parts about the wine business is because it is agricultural through and through.
Mm-hmm.
Starting in the vineyard, we're farming. But in the cellar, we are too. I mean, this is an investment. And
it's huge.
And it's not ready to bring to market for 18 months. So you have to cultivate this and take care of this thing, because it's alive after it's been harvested.
Yeah, that's one of the things that attract me to wine, is that it's this living, breathing thing that changes all the time and with time. I mean, there's not too many beverages or even things in life that are like that. It's pretty special.
Well, and the results come from how you finesse it and how you take care of it and how you nurture it.
Yeah, I mean, they always talk about you give 100, you know, 10, 100 winemakers the same grapes, and that's all going to be different.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. Let's move into that modern term. You know, Jeremy, you brought that up. What does modern wine mean?
Wow, I can't believe we're going here. This is
you started.
I know. It's.
Get your philosophy.
I think 2 days ago we were talking about it because what is modern winemaking? That's the question.
Yeah, that's the question.
Well, it's funny because when I started making wine about 12 years ago, modern was 16% alcohol with 5 grams residual sugar.
I would say, especially in your part of the world.
And 80% new oak. That was modern.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right?
And now that's kind of like dad rock. You know, that's like that's like Fish, right? The band, you know? Now I think, like Chad was talking about, I think modern, I think really what the consumer wants and what I want as a winemaker is it's very taboo, but balance.
And what balance is good.
And it's a constant pendulum that's swinging from that old modern style to the new modern style, which I think is the polar opposite, which is people making wine with low alcohol just to make wine with low alcohol. And I don't believe in that. That's where the balance comes in. I want the wine to be ripe and fruit driven, but nuanced at the same time.
All right. Chad, do you have anything to add to that?
Well, one thing I was thinking of what we were talking about is when you get modern, then it's kind of what is historic and you kind of go back to Europe. And there's a big approachability factor, I think, in modern wines. If someone comes to my tasting room and it's a hard tannic wine, but you tell them you have to wait for 20 years to drink it, it'll be awesome and it probably will be, but they're not going to buy the wine and I'm going to be out of business. So I think that's a huge part of modern winemaking style as well. Our wines, we've tasted some with age on it from back in the beginning and that they're holding up, but it certainly wasn't our intent to make a wine that would just last for 20 years back then. You just kind of make it different, and that probably wouldn't be a modern style.
Well, partly you have to get the confidence of your consumers. If they believe in your wine, then they're going to buy that wine that needs to age for
they'll follow you a little bit.
Right.
Absolutely. Like Neil Young when he got into total country music. A lot of great artists do that.
As far as palates, you know, long ago, far away, when Sutter Home started, it was White Zinfandel. Are you finding that as time goes on that the palates of your tasters that come into your wine tasting rooms are changing and evolving, and how are you addressing that? When you say approachability, is it still a little bit the starter of having a little sweetness in wine?
I don't think it's so much of a function of sweetness necessarily. I mean, sure, there's the perception of, but I think Chad and I both make dry wine chemically. But one thing I have noticed in the 12 years doing this that I think consumers in general care more now about where what they buy comes from and what they put in their bodies. And I think that that is one of the elements that makes wine so special to me, is because it brings people together, and that's the foundation of it. It brings families and friends together. And wine, people have this emotional connection to, because it goes well with food, and we're social.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, experiential.
Right?
Yeah.
And you get intoxicated by it, and it goes well with food. So that whole experience really enriches people's lives, and being a part of that is really cool. And I think that also the modern consumer is interested in the process. And now that the largest group of people, the millennials, the largest group we've ever seen.
Seriously?
And yeah. They have money now.
Right.
A lot of disposable income, but want quality. And they will not stand for...
And authenticity.
Yep. And authenticity, you don't make up.
No, you can't do that. It has to be real. Authentic? Real? Ratings influence how many of us buy wine. We take what experts deem as good wines and believe these are the wines we should be drinking and loving. Let's hear what the wine masters have to say about those numbers critics come up with.
We do some blind tastings on a regular basis. You know, we've got huge scoring wines versus some of the wines we make, or more often than not, those bigger, badder wines, they don't fare so well.
Right.
I don't think the consumer likes them, but they're so trained to buy it because it's 95 or 100 points. So they're letting that dictate what they should like.
Yes, it dictates a lot.
But when they do that on their own, they don't typically like those wines as much.
Wine. Interesting.
And then we test them in the winery. Chemically, we do a panel on them. And those are the wines typically with more faults and sugar and all those things in it.
Because they stand out.
Yeah.
And if you're a critic, you know, and you're tasting 100 wines.
I'll literally line up.
In a day. I'm guessing 90% of those wines are very well made.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And have a lot in common. And then there's a few that just stand out. So those are the ones that sometimes people gravitate towards because they're so wildly different, whether they're flawed, sweet, or just plowed in with oak.
That is interesting.
And I guess with my point with all that too is that just let people trust their palate. You know, I know it's tough for people to choose when they're looking at a wall of wine at a retail shop or a giant list. But when I got into wine, I found a retailer I liked, and I went in and they guided me through it. We tasted wines. I'd come back and buy more. It's like, I like this. I didn't like that. Or when I literally almost every time I go to a restaurant with a Somme or something, I what's your favorite? What's hot right now? What are you grooving on? And it turned me on to something.
Yeah. No, it's trust your palate. You know, your palate's going to tell you like, yeah, that is really delicious.
And if that is Sutter Home White Zinfandel, good for you.
Right.
Well, like Gary Vee said it, you know, 10 years ago, trust your palate.
Yeah.
Someone cannot tell you what's good wine. You have to decide that for yourself.
Yeah. So what wines do the winemasters make that they most love?
Sure.
You know, I'm going to start with you, Chad.
I guess, you know, we're doing more estate wines that we actually grow and dig in the dirt and that we've planted and seeing those through to bottle in the glass, sharing those people, that's to fruition. That's the ultimate. Not that I'm not incredibly proud of some of the grapes we buy and turn in and craft and make wine with. I mean, to me, that was to take a risk of buying a piece of property and having the vision to plant a certain clone and a varietal there. And 10 years later now, it's starting to express itself and act like an adult instead of a bit child or a teenager, what you can get out of it. I mean, that's a journey. And I've been on that journey with some of those wines for a long time. So that's pretty cool.
A major commitment.
Yeah. As we were talking about this, if you're not a patient person, this business will teach you patience. And it's agriculture, and you have no control over Mother Nature, and you live and die by Mother Nature. Every vintage is a little different. That's another thing that makes it special.
I'm inspired by you all. I could never be a farmer. It's too unpredictable for me. Jeremy, what about you? Those wines, sans ratings, sans popularity, what are you most proud of what you make?
I think the wine that I'm most proud of right now is the 2015 Amour Fatigue Grenache. Grenache it's a passionate variety for me.
And why is that?
I love to drink it, number one. I mean, it's got it all.
Yeah.
It's got complexity. It's got a lot. It's fruit driven, and it works so great with all kinds of food, whether it's like really fancy like cuisine that I didn't make, but also just the everyday stuff that my wife and I cook. It works great at the table. It's got acidity, but it's got depth and volume.
At the Winemaster Symposium during Festival Week, the winemasters introduced their wines to an audience about 40 people at the Northern Hotel. We had an opportunity to taste their wines paired with food prepared by executive chef Peter Burke. Well, I'm going to ask you this question, Jeremy. You professed to be the rabble rouser last night when I was at the seminar.
I had drinks with him afterwards. He got a little crazy.
Did he? He really did rouse.
I lived up to it,
yes. All right. I wanted to touch on the label art of your wine bottles. In your area of the world, Bonnie Doon and Sin Qua Non have had very unique wine labels. Your labels for your wines are avant-garde, funky, frightening, which was brought up last night, and fun. Why is your company chosen to do this? Let's start with the Rabble Wine Company's rosé with a maiden with long hair, a bare back, and a fishtail.
The siren.
Yes.
We've always gone after to be different, and the rabble is just that. We want people to think differently and drink differently. You know, we're disorderly, and we're the mob, and we're sometimes drunk.
All right. But very happy most of the time.
Yeah. Where did the artwork come from for the rosé? So it's got a siren on it.
Yes.
All of the rabble wines are inspired by the Nuremberg Chronicles and all feature some act of destruction. We're all about death and destruction. Of course, the siren historically was this beautiful sea creature who had the shape of a woman with a tail.
And you told us she was not a mermaid.
No, sirens are not mermaids.
Right.
She's so beautiful, and she has the prettiest song that she sings. So the sailors, that you can't avoid coming to check her out. And then she draws you in, then she kills you. And that's historically what the sirens did. There's tons of literature about these creatures.
And you want the consumer to buy your rosé with that message.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
And it's pink.
Yes, it is. It's a very pretty pink, too.
I don't think there's any risk of death by drinking it, though, is there?
No. Don't take a lot of rosé.
And then tell us a little bit about the Possessor.
That's the Tooth and Nail brand. So those are all our blended brand with a leading varietal. And Tooth and Nail is inspired by John James Audubon. And I will mention that all of the artwork on our wines is over 100 years old and in the public domain. We've taken creative freedom with this artwork that's already out there.
The
John James Audubon, the naturalist in the 19th century, did all these drawings and accounts of the creatures in the world. The Soul Possessor, as he wrote, features two red-tailed hawks fighting over a dead rabbit. And this brand is really focused about that struggle that we see on a daily basis in nature. Yeah, that's the struggle, the hawks and the bird and the rabbit, but that parallels our lives.
Mm-hmm.
We're lucky enough to go to the grocery store or farm to survive, but at the end of the day, it's a struggle.
But we do have good bottles of wine to consume
right.
at the end of the day, to sip and savor, to save us. Thanks again to Winemasters Jeremy Leffert and Chad Johnson. In the second part of the show, we look at the best tool for wine tasting, the glass. I'm sitting across Doug Reed, Regional Sales Manager for Rita Wineglass, and he's here to illustrate to us how a glass really makes the difference in our tasting experience of wine. Thanks for joining me, Doug.
Very happy to be here. Thank you for having me. And I want to congratulate you and just mention at the very start here, you did pronounce it correctly. It seems like wherever I go, I'm constantly reminding people that Riedel is the high school from Greece and they make football helmets. But Riedel like Needle for the last 11 generations and the 262 years that the company's been in business. The Riedel family were always glass makers. They always made, whether it was wine glasses or goods for the home. And again, it's a multi-generational company. And it was the 1950s, the ninth generation of the family, Mr. Klaus Riedel, started to notice that when he would drink his favorite wines from different sizes and shapes of glasses, he would get a different experience out of each different shape. So this, you know, begged him to ask the question, could he produce the perfect shape for his favorite wine, which was Burgundy, Pinot Noir to make it simple. And he gathered friends of his together and sat them down. And these were very special people in the world of Burgundy that knew these wines very intimately. And they collectively held a workshop, if you will, where they all tested different sizes and shapes. And they all gave their input as to what worked, what didn't work. And they compiled all this data. And what Klaus Riedel produced was this glass. More remarkably, it was the world's first what we call varietal specific wine glass. It was designed to give the best possible aroma, mouthfeel, flavor. Before this glass came along, wine glasses for, I always say hundreds, but probably literally thousands of years, people that were making things to drink from were making them with two purposes to them. They needed to be decorative on the table and they needed to hold liquid. That was where the thought process started. This was the first time anybody really put any thought into what the shape of the bowl would do as far as aroma, what the thickness of the rim would do as far as placement of the wine on the palate, you know, all these little intricate things that can really help us enjoy wine.
The Riedel Sommelier Pinot Noir Burgundy glass takes on the shape of a voluptuous woman, where there appears to be a waistline in the middle of the glass with a full bottom and wider top.
This glass had a lot to do also with the 1950s and tail fins of beautiful Chevrolets and Marilyn Monroe as far as its statuesque nature, but probably really did have more to do with wine than that.
Reed sets up his wine tasting experience with tasting wine in a paper cup, in a standard restaurant glass, and then in Riedel's designated wine glass. In his classes, he takes the students through the experience of white and red wines, but in our case, we will experience only a red wine. So let's begin.
If you think of all five of your senses, what's the very first sense you're going to utilize when you approach a glass of wine? And it's funny, they always say, well, the nose. And I always point out, well, hopefully we're all looking at whatever we're going to consume because that's our first line of defense, right? As far as protecting us from something that might hurt us. Notice all the Riedel glasses, very, very clear, no decoration, no design to them. We can see exactly what's in our glass. And it's amazing the amount of things we can tell about our wine simply by the way it looks. And sometimes we can tell if our wine is bad or spoiled or corked or tainted just by the way it looks, just by the color.
Unfortunately, the heavier, thicker standard restaurant wine glass tells a different story.
We actually bring along glass like this non-Riedel glass, and you know, when we compare these glasses side by side, I have them hold them over the tasting mat, and you'll start to see color in this glass, a little bluish, greenish tinge. Unfortunately, when we drink wine from this glass, it doesn't allow us to see the true color of the wine.
And this glass is the glass that you would find at any restaurant that you would go to. It's thicker, and you did say it has almost a bluish tinge to it. It's one of those that I believe that restaurants buy because they are sturdy.
I get a kick when I talk to restaurateurs, and restaurateurs oftentimes will tell me about the care and all the steps they'll go through to procure their ingredients, their flatware, their table lighting, everything about their restaurant. And then I look at the wine glass and I'm thinking, well, why did you stop there? I mean, because the wine glass really functions as a messenger for the wine. I mean, it has to. In fact, to put this in perspective, you know, what a lot of people don't realize is that when we look at a glass of wine, between water and alcohol, this comprises 99% of what's in our glass. There is literally 1% of material that defines what our wine is. So now when we think about that wine glass and its job of having to literally decode and be a loudspeaker for that 1%, we start to think about the wine glass in a little bit different idea, if you will. So again, this is exactly what we're trying to do with the Riedel glasses, glasses that will appeal to all of our senses and give us the best possible message of the wine that the glass was designed for.
Let's get started. In my hand, I have this paper cup, so we're talking about the loudspeaker. Let's see how loudly this paper cup speaks of the wine.
Well, let me make a little noise going in. We're going to put just a little bit in there.
So what we do at the seminar is we're going to compare between a shape like this little paper cup. We're going to compare wine out of sort of the everyday wine glass that we find all over. And then we're going to pour a little bit into the Rito glass. And when we do the seminars, it's really a journey of using your senses and determining, is there a difference in the way you experience the wine when you drink out of different sizes and shapes of glasses? So I don't ever present this as good, bad, or better, or worse. It's just simply, is it different? And if the only thing that's changed is the glass, because we're not changing the wine, if the only thing that's changing is the glass and our experience is different, then maybe it's the glass that's causing these things to happen. So when we start with the paper cup, I usually give it a little swirl to sort of warm it up in here, but I'll have them put their nose into the glass, sort of get a level, if you will, or some benchmarks as far as aroma goes. Maybe depths of aroma, strengths of aroma. Maybe sometimes we can pick out individual things.
In experiencing the Cabernet Sauvignon, I found the paper cup did not really highlight the wine. It smelled and tasted flat. With a standard restaurant glass, I began to sense the aromas and flavors, but it was with the designated Cabernet glass that the fruit flavors and aromas intensified and non-fruit flavors came into play. Also, my mouth and nose were much happier drinking out of the Rito glass.
A metaphor I always like to use, I said, you know, you can go pay money to go see the Mona Lisa, all right? And you can either look at it through a little paper towel tube and see just a little bit of it, or you can look at it in its entire, in all of its grandeur, if you will. And to me, that explains what we're doing with these different shapes.
So what should we be experiencing in a glass of red wine?
Red wines in general have these four flavor contributors to them that we always talk about. We have fermented juice, we have yeast, we have oak, and we have tannin. And the tannin comes from the skins of the grape. That's what skins give these red wines their color. And one thing that's really fun to do is to see how the tannins will vary between glass to glass to glass as far as their intensity.
When you talk about tannins, actually, it gives the structure to the wine. But
absolutely.
At the same time, we can liken the feeling of tannins to chewing a tea bag.
Exactly.
That leaves that kind of furry rug feel on
yes.
your tongue.
And it's definitely something that we want as part of our experience, but we don't want it to overshadow our experience in wine.
The next point Reed brings up is perhaps a nuance we don't often think about. In class, there are four wine-specific glasses, one for Riesling, Oak Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, and Cabernet.
So there's a lot of mechanics that happen with your tongue when you're drinking. When you're drinking, say, from a very narrow glass, like glass number two, which is designed for our Rieslings and our Sauvignon Blancs, because of the narrowness of the rim, when you drink from that glass, you don't even think about this, but you're having to tilt your head back. And when you tilt your head back to drink from a glass, your tongue comes forward automatically. It's a reflex. You don't have any control over it. Well, on the very tip of your tongue, these are where your sweet receptors are. So the wine glass is literally positioning the wine on the part of our palate where we want that sort of first flavor snapshot. And so all four of these different glasses give us different positions on our palate on what we want to accentuate out of the wine.
But let's not forget, there is one more sense.
Hearing, right? We haven't talked about hearing. And I always joke and tell them that the glasses don't talk to you. And if they do, they need to go do something else. But we talk about toasting. And when we toast with our wine glass, we always want to make sure that we're toasting the widest part of our bowl to the widest part of our other bowl. And if we do it correctly, we'll have a nice, lovely ring to it that will commemorate your event or your experience you're celebrating with that wine.
Many thanks to Chad Johnson, Jeremy Lefford, and Doug Reed for making my wine world more delicious. Thanks to Parker Brown for the theme music. Additional funding has been provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montana. Let's continue to celebrate the bounty of our region. I'm Stella Fong.